Böyle.
Evening, Chairperson.
Yes, how are you, Honorable Mufuke?
I'm very well, and how are you, Chair?
And I'm okay, thanks. I don't see other members of the opposition here. I can see Honorable Velma, Honorable Nomathemba Jele, Honorable Mfukeng, myself. At some point, Honorable Mola joined, but maybe he might be experiencing some connection problems. But because it's a public hearing, we shall proceed. Let me start by welcoming everybody and the viewers at home in these public hearings on gender-based violence. I will start by making some few announcements. The first announcement that we have is that one of our members, Honorable Maseko Jele, is celebrating her birthday today. I would like to say happy birthday to you, Honorable Maseko Jele.
Thank you, Chairperson.
If you were in Parliament, I was going to buy you a cake, but now we will buy you a cake in spirit. And we encourage everybody whose birthday is due to tell us so that we can celebrate with them. I have also asked the committee secretariat to circulate the advert that we made when we were inviting people for public comments. Reason being, in the advert, it is clearly stated that people who want to have verbal submissions, to make verbal submissions in Parliament, may so indicate. And there has been concerns raised around that, one by the EFF, that they did try to make to be included in the list of organizations that would want to make verbal comments, of which we agreed that they must contact the committee secretariat. But in the programming committee, it was raised that certain people were not allowed to make verbal comments. And I can confirm that the secretariat has ensured that everybody who indicated that he or she wants to make oral presentation to the committee was allowed. There was no criteria to exclude anybody. But those people who met the deadline of the 30th of September but did not indicate that they want to make verbal or oral presentation and they've changed their minds and they want to make oral presentation will indicate to the committee secretariat so that they can be allowed to do that. But people who did not meet the deadline, which means people who did not make the submissions by the 30th of September, as it was indicated, would not be allowed because there is a deadline for a reason. If we can have a process that does not have deadlines, we will never be able to conclude this bill. The issue of gender-based violence is quite urgent, sensitive. It needs us to move with speed to assist in the fight against gender-based violence and femicide. So people who met the deadline of the 30th of September and did not indicate that they wanted, at that time did not indicate that they wanted to make oral presentation to the committee, would contact the committee secretariat and we would be advised as such. The third announcement that I think is important, we have received two apologies. One from the Women Legal Center that they are driving, so they will not be able to connect. And then even from Professor Skelton. they have made a request that they be rescheduled for tomorrow for them to be able to make their oral presentation. I will now put that to the committee for the committee to consider that. If the committee agrees, then that would mean that we would not adjourn at 2 o'clock and we will attend around 4:30 tomorrow morning. Is that agreeable, members?
It's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, and good evening, Honorable Breitenbach.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you very much. So today we will start with the following: the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. Have they connected?
Yes, Chairperson, I'm here, Mike Portier.
Thank you very much and welcome, sir. Thank you very much for making yourself available to make oral presentations to the committee. We will give you 20 minutes to make your presentation. That will be followed by 30 minutes of questions for members to want to understand your presentation much more better, so that when we discuss, we don't misrepresent what you have presented. So we will start now. We'll hand over to you to make the presentation.
Before you start, please.
Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you very much, Chair. I thought you were going to allow us to engage with you on the issue of the submissions. I think I want to register that it's very unfair that the submissions were closed on the 30th of September and nobody said anything until when Honorable Yaku raised it here. And I said it even that day that I don't see your submission, and their submission was actually a written one. It's okay, Chair, but really a member must be honest and say the truth about what was supposed to happen. If they failed as EFF to can do the right thing at that time, they were supposed to say that, but they must not say that they were not considered. Our officials are doing a lot of work and we should respect what they are doing. And we know them and we know that they do their work. I mean, out of 1,000 something submissions, we had 52 that were verbal, were actually oral submission. And 1,000 plus, we know that they are actually submissions that are written. And their submission is amongst those ones. They were just supposed to ask nicely, but not made an issue and even go to a programming to use their power in the wrong way. I want to say that on the side of ANC, Chair, we are saying that allow them, but it's not right.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mfokeng. I think that is noted. It's well noted what you have said.
Say something, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you. Firstly, I'd like to, I'm not sure if you received his apology. Mr. Horn is unavailable. He's on the flight. So his apology, please.
Okay.
And then I would align myself with the comments of the Honorable Mfokeng.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, it's really, we should not cast aspersions unnecessary on our officials when they do their work diligently. I think it has been unfortunate and hurting to create an impression that they deliberately did not include other people. But let's move from that, Honorable Members, we note your concerns and we note what you have said. Can we start with the South African Catholic Bishops Conference?
Good evening, Chairperson, thank you. Good evening to members of the committee and to others who are in on this call. I've been doing parliamentary committees since about 1996, I think, and this is the first time that I have had to say good evening, and the first time that I'm addressing the committee through a laptop. So times are changing, and it's good that we can adapt and take them in our stride. I think this year has taught us a lot of new skills, and it's a pleasure to see how well Parliament has coped with these exigencies. Chairperson, as you will have seen, we made brief written submissions on two of the three bills that are before you. We did not find it necessary to say anything in particular about the Criminal Law Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act Amendment Bill. It's not that we don't find it important. We don't see the need to make what for us would have been fairly technical, or to deal with fairly technical aspects. The Church in general has a deep concern of violence against women, violence against children, sexual violence, etc., etc. The whole world knows, and I'll say this up front, that the Catholic Church is not innocent in these matters. We preach one thing, and all too often, unfortunately, our members do something else. We're very much aware of that, and we take the issue very, very seriously. So the fact that we did not comment on that particular bill is not an indication that we don't take it seriously, simply that we didn't feel we had anything specific to contribute on that bill. We do have something to say on the two other bills that are before you. I should just have mentioned, excuse me, that one of my colleagues is also in on this meeting, Lois Law, who works with me, and Lois has done a good deal of the research behind our submissions, and in fact, she runs our project that looks at policy and legislation around women and children and family issues, which of course involves very much the whole field of domestic violence. Chairperson, if I may begin by referring to the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. Our submissions are quite short and to the point, nothing very complex. So I'm just going to refer to what we've done, what we've said in our written submission. We start with clauses 2 to 5 of the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill, which are in effect the new provisions relating to bail, and we want to express our support for those clauses. Clause 2 and Clause 3 respectively in effect prohibit the granting of police bail and the granting of bail by the Director of Public Prosecutions for people accused of these offences. And we think that's correct. It's more proper that an accused be brought before a court, as they are with what are traditionally considered more serious crimes, and that they make their case before a magistrate, not simply before a police officer or a prosecutor. That reflects the gravity of the kind of offence we are dealing with here. Secondly, we support Clause 4, which provides that in considering bail, the court must take into consideration the view of any person against whom the offence was allegedly committed. This again just makes a lot of sense that given especially the domestic setting of many of these offences, the people who are most intimately connected to the applicant for bail should be able to say their say. And then Clause 5, which provides for the cancellation of bail in certain circumstances where an accused person contravenes an order imposed on him in terms of the, or her, I suppose, in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, or the Protection of Harassment Act, or where the person fails to disclose that there is such an order. Again, those are both elements of bad faith, and they would give a court good reason, I think, to suspect that the person may reoffend or intimidate a witness or otherwise not respect the bail conditions. So a cancellation of bail under those circumstances is something to be supported. I move to Clause 9, which deals with the complainant's rights regarding parole. And here again, we would like to support the amendment. This is an amendment to Section 299 Big A of the Criminal Procedure Act, which in effect means that a complainant in a domestic violence case will have the right to make representations regarding parole. However, this only seems to apply when the person has been sentenced to 7 years or more. And we question why that should be the case. In the ordinary nature of things, a 7-year sentence for a domestic violence offense would be an extremely heavy sentence. People get 7 years of imprisonment for attempted murder, for assault, GBH, etc., etc. Many people might end up being sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 2 or 3 or 4, 5 years or whatever for domestic violence offenses. Why should the complainant not be heard on the question of parole after a 5-year sentence or a 4-year sentence? So that threshold of 7 years seems to be, with respect, a little bit arbitrary. And we would encourage the committee to investigate that, perhaps hear from the department or the drafters why they settled on 7 years, and perhaps consider giving the complainant the right to have their say on the question of parole, whatever the length of the prison sentence has been. If a person is sent to prison, it sounds serious enough that the complainant should have an opportunity to be heard on the question of parole. That brings me to clauses 11 to 17 of the bill, all of which deal with the extension, one way or the other, of minimum sentence provisions. Some of these clauses increase the level of mandatory minimum sentence applicable to offences which are already covered by the Minimum Sentence Act 105 of 1997. Others make that minimum sentence regime applicable to offences under the Domestic Violence Act. Others broaden the description of some offences, particularly by extending age limits and so on. Others broaden categories of victims and complainants that are involved in the relevant offences. We are asking the committee to take a broad view of all of these clauses. It's not that we specifically object to any one of them in particular, and we understand what the purpose is. But when I mention a broad view, what I mean is that the general minimum sentence regime in this country was initially intended as a short-term intervention to address high rates of serious crime. As members of the committee will know, it came into effect in 1997, 23 years ago. The debates in Parliament were held in 1996, 24 years ago, when serious crime was, as it is today, a matter of widespread concern. And Parliament decided to enact minimum sentence legislation for a period of 2 years in order to come down hard and sharply on serious crime and hopefully make a difference, send out that message to perpetrators that if you do this or that kind of crime, you're going to get life or you're going to get 15 years or 10 years or whatever. Now we're sitting, so say, 24 years later, and this piece of legislation is permanently on the statute book. It no longer needs to be renewed every year or every 2 years as it did at one stage. And yet violent crime of all descriptions is still with us. By most measures, it's getting worse. More and more people are being sent to prison for longer and longer periods of time. And we don't seem to be making much of a difference. So why add further offenses to the minimum sentence regime? Why add more and more people to prison with long minimum sentences if it apparently doesn't work? And I certainly never come across a study that shows that it does work. And Chairperson, this is important not just as a matter of, you know, penal law or criminology or whatever. It's not even only important as a matter of prison overcrowding, although I think that that is a very serious problem because prison overcrowding leads to poor conditions, which leads to poor prospects of rehabilitation, et cetera, et cetera. What's more important for our purposes here and what we say in the final paragraph of our written submission is that legislating for more severe punishments without at the same time taking steps to address the real reasons for the persistence of crimes such as the ones we're dealing with risks being seen as window dressing. People will say, well, look, all that Parliament has done is to impose heavier sentences, longer prison terms on a greater number of offences, and then sort of sit back, pat themselves on the back and say, you see, we are acting against these forms of violence, domestic violence, sexual violence, etc., etc. And yet you won't really be acting against them because, as I said, there's no evidence to suggest that these extensive minimum sentences actually achieve their object. I think what many other presenters have said to you over the last few days, and we would endorse it, is that the much harder work of changing attitudes and mindsets needs to happen before we simply lock people up and throw away the key and think mistakenly that we've made a big difference to the problem that way. So, Chairperson, very briefly, those are our comments regarding the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill. And I'd like to move on, if I may, to the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill, where once again we wish to support very strongly some of the proposed amendments and at the same time also raise our concerns with others of them. In our written submission in paragraph 2, we note some of the changes, proposed changes to definitions, and we support the addition of definitions for coercive behavior and controlling behavior. Both of those we think will expand the reach of the principal act over harmful types of behavior that were missed out before. We also support the inclusion of elder abuse and of spiritual abuse. And then we support the definitions further on in that section of how elder abuse and spiritual abuse are defined. And finally, there, the new definition of harassment seems to be an improvement over the old definition. Just a brief word on the definition of spiritual abuse. We are perhaps not 100% happy with the first part A of that definition, where it says spiritual abuse means ridiculing or insulting the complainant's religious or spiritual beliefs. We have freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and this is an age-old problem. Where does that end? If I wish to ridicule your belief because I think it's completely mad, I'm not necessarily abusing you in the process. So that part A of the definition may be a little bit tenuous, and it's the sort of thing ultimately which a court may have to decide upon. But part C, using the complainant's religious or spiritual beliefs to justify, minimize, or rationalize abusive behavior. That's the important part to be included there. And we've seen many examples of late of this happening in churches and what I would term so-called churches. So by and large, we support the inclusion of that type of abuse. I want to move, before I deal with the mandatory reporting aspect, which is the most weighty part of our submission, I think, to one or two other proposed amendments which we support in this bill. At paragraph 2.3 of my written submission, the applications for protection orders and associated matters, we note that these provisions aim to make it easier for complainants to obtain protection orders. We welcome the introduction of online submission of applications as set out in Clause 6. I think we've seen in many ways during this pandemic that the courts have been able to operate and to issue various orders and deal with certain applications online. It has worked, as far as I know, quite efficiently, and it has not really prejudiced people in any meaningful way. So this is a good way of, I think, making it easier for these domestic violence interdicts and so on to be obtained. We also support the proposed provisions relating to the furnishing of particulars of electronic communications to the court. A lot of emotional and psychological abuse, as we know, is carried out through electronic communication, cell phones, etc. So it's good that the principle will actually be amended to take that into account. We also support the proposed amendments contained in Clause 13 that would allow the seizure of a weapon, which is under the control of a respondent to a protection order, regardless of the requirements of the respondent's employment to possess such a weapon. This clearly takes into account the fact, the unfortunate fact, that a large number of members of the SA Police Service and also the SANDF not to mention private security companies and so on. In other words, people who are routinely armed and who take their arms home, that a large number of them unfortunately become involved in domestic violence. And in the past, it may have been that they've been able to retain possession of those weapons for the reason that their employment requires it. So this little provision is a very important one, and we support that strongly. That brings me then to the final point I want to make, which is the one around mandatory reporting. And I know, again, a number of organizations have already addressed you on this question. I don't want to be unnecessarily repetitive, but I do want to express also our very deep reservations and indeed our objection to some of what is proposed here. The intention behind the proposed new sections 2A and 2B clearly is to make it more difficult for acts of domestic violence to remain hidden and for perpetrators to escape liability. And we obviously support that intention. But mandatory reporting will not necessarily achieve that intention. We suggest it may end up achieving the opposite. Along the way, it is going to violate people's dignity and their agency, their autonomy. It's going to end up disempowering a lot of people. It can also have the unintended consequence of concealing rather than revealing acts of domestic violence. And we suggest that it will end up criminalizing some people who are themselves victims of domestic violence. Let me deal with each of those assertions in order. Violation of dignity and disempowerment. A core component of the right to dignity is that people should have the right to make decisions concerning themselves for themselves, and as far as possible, not have those decisions made for them by other people. And this surely includes the decision that a complainant, or as I've put it for convenience in my submission, a victim of domestic violence, the decision that he or she makes about whether or not to report it, to deprive the person of that right, takes away an element of the power that that person has over their own life. It deprives them of their agency to some extent. It violates their dignity. It says to the person, we know better than you. The government, the state, parliament knows better than you whether this particular thing should or should not be reported.
How are we talking? Yes, 2 minutes left.
Thank you. We're talking here about people who are adults. The situation is different when the complainant is not in a position to make the report themselves, such as children, people with certain levels of intellectual disability. That's completely different. I would say that these sections make the error of treating older people, anyone who has turned 60, and people with physical disabilities, as if they were mentally or intellectually impaired. The definition of disability is far too wide. That needs to be attended to. You've heard from other people, and we support this line of argument, that this could end up concealing acts of domestic violence. If somebody knows that if they go to a doctor or a social worker or a counselor or whoever to talk about the fact that they are a victim of domestic violence, that that other person is going to be forced by law to report it, the person may choose not to seek help. There's no point in that. It can only make the cycle continue. But perhaps our most important objection, Chair, finally, is that it criminalizes victims. And I want to suggest to you this scenario. An 18-year-old daughter sees her father physically assault her mother. The law makes that 18-year-old daughter a criminal if she does not go and report that assault to the authorities. I would argue that the 18-year-old is already a victim. She's a victim of emotional abuse, psychological abuse, seeing her father assault her mother. Does Parliament really want to then make her a criminal and redouble her victimization by saying, now you have to go and report that to the police and tell them what your father did to your mother? And if you don't, we can send you to jail for 3 months or fine you. That surely cannot be the intention of the drafters of the legislation, but that is its effect. And it goes one step worse, Chair. If you read Section 2 B, that is the proposed new Section 2 Big B, very carefully. It says, an adult person who has knowledge that an act of domestic violence has been committed against an adult in a domestic relationship must report it. It does not say another adult. A plain reading of this means that a victim of domestic violence must report it herself or himself. And that, again, cannot be the intention of Parliament. It sounds absurd, but the plain reading means that if a person who is themselves the victim of domestic violence doesn't take steps to report it, they commit an offence and can also be jailed. Now, you might say that's definitely not the intention. No court would do that, and you may be right. But why not? Why should we not make victims of domestic violence report it themselves? If you don't want to make them report it themselves, then you have to ask yourself with respect, why do you want to make their children report it, or their brothers or sisters, or their family members, or their close friends, or anybody else?
Thank you very much, Mr. Papia.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I will now open for members to ask clarity-seeking questions and make comments. We have Honorable Kobo Dile Janje as the first person, followed by Honorable Mufokeng, followed by Honorable Maseko Jele, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair. We'll be brief as you directed us. I just want first to acknowledge and appreciate the presentation by the Catholic Bishops Conference. Just to make the point that in 2020, to have the Catholic Bishops Conference participating in Parliament on a gender on all these three bills is quite welcoming, knowing the journey that the Catholic Bishops Conference traveled in this country during the most difficult times. And here you remember your father, Simangaliso Mkhatshwa, John Napier, and then a former member of parliament from that, Bernard Ncube. So I really want to say, Chair, I really want to acknowledge that they've remained with an interest about societal issues. The quick, and I'm not raising that because I'm a Catholic, but I think it's important to reflect on that, Chair. But the second issue I want to raise, Chair, is I want to put it to the presenter. I heard him saying they support the definition of spiritual abuse. I want you to be much clearer than what you have said. That do you agree and accept that in this country we have had issues of spiritual abuse, including the Catholics, and that much as you are speaking about technical issues in terms of the definition, do you agree that it is proper that it is left there and there are a number of issues to be attended? I'm raising this because yesterday we had a lot of discussion about this, Chair. So I think it's proper that the Catholic bishops leave a stamp here in this parliament about that issue, so that we the freedom of religion for South Africa had a particular stance about it. Please ask us in your own understanding. Besides about the nuances that you are saying can be changed, it has to be empathic and so on. So that's the first point, Chair, if I think we can get that comment. And the last point, Chair, to be in line with your directive, I seem to be sympathetic, but it leaves me halfway. The issue you have raised about we need to hear the victim regardless of the period of the conviction. What are you effectively proposing in that regard? What do you want to leave with this committee for us to consider? I seem to be wanting to hear you and connecting you with that issue. Let me pause there, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Janji. Honorable Mufokeng.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the Catholic Bishops Conference for the presentation. Chair, I think I really need to commend them for bringing the submission, especially the oral one. And I want to also say that we appreciate you a lot. I saw that also the Methodist Church of South Africa, they did the submission, but it's a verbal one. And I want to join my colleague, Honorable Janji, on the issue of the spiritual abuse, because yesterday it really was an issue. And I want to check with you that the freedom of religion, do you agree with them on how they actually were dismissing things that are happening in this country, especially as Honorable Janji was saying that even our own churches are having some of those challenges of abuse. And for you to say that you support it, I think for us is something that is welcome. And that is where we want to say that please educate us more about this, especially when you listen to what they were saying. It really disturbs a lot. But the last question is going to be on the issue of parole. You are saying that the complainant not to be heard after, should be heard about at least 5 years if a person is supposed to be released on parole. Do you think our parole system is something that needs a review, or it's in order, or what are you thinking about it? Because I'm sure the information that is there is based on the parole system that is there. What are you saying about our parole system at the moment? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mufukeng, Honorable Namatemba Maseko Chele.
Thank you very much, Chair, and also thank you to Mr. Mike Putin for the presentation. And also, Chairperson, appreciating the church coming forward in also raising their voice in assisting to resolve such serious matters. But I have a few comments. I had Bishop, I don't know if maybe I'll be wrong if I call you, because I thought that you must be one of the bishops. Let me call you Mr. Mike. Portia, to be safe.
That's better.
Let me just take that route. You see, I heard him when he started acknowledging that there have been bad behaviors coming from the church, issues pertaining to GBV. And obviously the church or the Catholic Bishop Conference, I should think that the mere fact that they have interest here, they acknowledge the seriousness of this matter. But my concern, Chairperson, is that I grew up in a...
Honorable Charlie?
She seems to be frozen, Chair.
Yes. That's because she's the last person to speak before responses. Let's give her 1 minute.
No, let's proceed, Chair, to another speaker.
There is no other speaker, according to my list.
Then let's go to the responses.
No, I think we have lost Honorable Jelle. Over to you, Mr. Portia.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the members for your very kind words. Certainly do remember the late sister, Bernard Nube, and Father Smangaliso, who we see still from time to time at the Moral Regeneration Movement and elsewhere. Do I agree that we have had spiritual abuse? Yes, I do agree. Certainly we have. I think it's important to note, and it has been noted ever since this legislation came into force, that there's a lot of overlap between emotional abuse, psychological abuse, mental abuse, spiritual abuse. It's very difficult to define what these things are exactly. So it is appropriate that the law provides a fairly wide set of definitions so that somebody cannot use the excuse to say, well, it might have looked like I was being emotionally abusive to somebody, but in fact, it was my particular way of carrying out spiritual counseling. We've certainly seen physical abuse in this country being carried out under the cloak of pastoral care or spiritual care. We've seen people being displayed with doom and other such physical acts taken against them. And it said, oh, this is some sort of spiritual activity, which with respect is clearly nonsense. But until the law quite clearly outlaws such behavior, we cannot be certain of capturing that offense. And so I think that the inclusion of spiritual abuse in that sense is a worthwhile thing to do. I did not see the whole of the presentation yesterday by 4SA. I did pick up a little bit of what they were saying about the spiritual abuse question. We work with 4SA on certain questions, and we often agree with their standpoint, but we don't always agree with their standpoint, and there's nothing wrong with that. We have our different opinions on certain things. I suspect that their major concern would be that people might be able to use this provision around spiritual abuse if they so wish to start clamping down on freedom of religion and freedom of spiritual activities and expression of spiritual beliefs, etc. I think it's possible to find the correct balance in these things. And we do not want a situation where people use their spiritual authority, their spiritual positions, as I say, as a cloak for abuse. So from our point of view, we are satisfied that there is a need for this definition, although I do repeat that the subsection A part of the definition, which speaks only about insulting or ridiculing, that may end up falling foul of our constitutional provisions regarding freedom of speech. Shall I carry on, Chair?
Yes, please proceed.
The other questions, both from Honourable Dianti and Honourable Mofokeng, both had to do with the question of parole. What we have at the moment in the intended provision is that it says when a court sentences a person to imprisonment for, and then it lists murder or killing a person, rape or compelled rape, robbery, etc., sexual assault, and so on, then the complainant must be given a chance to be heard. It doesn't specify a term of imprisonment for the offences of rape and assault and robbery, etc. But when we come to domestic violence, suddenly it says when a person is sentenced to a period exceeding 7 years for any offence committed against a person in a domestic relationship. So my simple question is why, for example, would the victim of attempted murder maybe, or robbery, or rape, be given the right to influence the question of parole when the criminal was sentenced to 5 years or 4 years? But if it's a domestic violence crime, only those that get sentenced to 7 years come into the picture. I would simply suggest that you remove reference to the 7 years. And just say, in effect, anyone, when anyone is sentenced to imprisonment for an offense in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, then the complainant must have the opportunity to be heard on the question of parole. And that puts domestic violence offenses on exactly the same footing as all the others that are listed in that section what is it, Section 299 Big A of the Criminal Procedure Act. Honourable Mofo King also asked more generally about the parole system, and I do practice criminal law, but I have nothing to do really with parole. I think that the parole system works as well as the parole boards work, and it works probably as well as rehabilitation efforts work in certain prisons. In other words, there's good and there's bad. I do think in general terms that there needs to be more public involvement, and in particular more involvement of the victims of the crime. Not necessarily just the person who was assaulted, for example, but the family members as well and so on. It needs to become a more inclusive process. And some members of the committee will of course know that I'm referring also to the principles of a kind of reconciliatory form of justice as well. There's a lot of scope in our parole system for that to be brought in. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think Honourable Masekwa Jele is back. I think it would be fair because we are still within our time to give an opportunity to ask a question.
Chairperson, I think I'll be very short because some of the answers that Mr. Potier has given, my question was in relation to the issue of the heavy sentence that he seemed not to be supporting in terms of 7 years and more. So he just gave us his view on that one. I think it was in relation to that, considering that I wanted to find out from him that don't they consider this a very serious matter, especially when it comes to even the country we're talking about, the second pandemic, and other organizations, they support this view of more and harder sentences when it comes to those issues of GBV. So I think he gave his view on that one. But on the issue of the spiritual abuse also, Chair, I wanted to come to that one. Considering that he is coming from the church fraternity, do you consider this definition cover also the issues of, you know, a human being? We talk about, when we talk about the issue of spirituality, we don't only consider the outside issues. We're talking also in terms of the human being a spirit. You would understand what I'm talking about. No. A human being, yes, as a spirit. So I don't know, what is your view on that one? If you can maybe elaborate more in terms of, are you happy that this talks about issues which might be talking about, if you criticize my spirituality or speech, my beliefs and all that. So can you just say something maybe on this, a person as a spirit in terms of this abuse? Because if this child has been abused from the smaller age, obviously his spirit has been messed up. And that is why when we grow up, we find adults who are doing things that are really not normal, because their spirits have been tempered with when they were little ones, you know. So I think I would like to hear your comment on that one. Also, on the last chairperson, on the issue of reporting, mandatory reporting, I just want to find out that if maybe the bishops conference, have they considered the issue of the type of society that we have inherited, the type with which our people, our society is in different levels? We still have people that need to be assisted. We talk about the people, for example, from the rural areas. Those people, they still have to get this information, or if they don't, they don't know about these issues because of the level of education also. Illiteracy is still a problem in our country. people can't read about this. In some areas, in the rural areas, they still don't have television, you know. So this information comes very little to them. And if I stay in that area, I'm a social worker or I'm a police or anybody at the level where I can assist in reporting of the wrong that is happening in that community. Don't you see that as an important factor? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Porfia, I think some of the questions you have answered them. I think it was during the time when Honorable Jelle was disconnected. But you can just repeat some of the issues you've raised.
If you look at the definition of spiritual abuse or the proposed new definition, it talks about a complainant's religious or spiritual beliefs. I appreciate what Honorable Maseko Jelle says about, you know, the internality of one's spirit, one's spirituality, etc. I'm not sure that this definition really goes that far. It seems to be more trying to protect people from attacks on their religious or spiritual beliefs, and as it says, attempts to control them or to manipulate them or shame them, etc., via their spiritual or religious beliefs. And as I did say before, whenever you have this kind of thing, you run up against the rights of the other person, the right to freedom of speech, etc. We don't want a situation where we cannot criticize each other's beliefs, be they religious or spiritual or philosophical or whatever other kind of beliefs. A large part of what makes us human is that we can have those debates and discussions. And sometimes, yes, we feel a little bit hurt by what somebody else has said. But I don't think that that is what is intended behind this definition of spiritual abuse. We're talking here more of the abuse of spiritual authority to carry out, to belittle people, to cause them serious harm. The mandatory reporting question, I appreciate the point that is made that, yes, some people do need to be assisted and some people don't have access to information, etc. But with respect, I don't think that that makes a very big difference to the underlying problems with mandatory reporting. The fact that it may end up concealing rather than revealing the problem, the fact that it may end up making criminals of people who are themselves victims of domestic violence. And in any event, it's most unlikely that the provisions that you are dealing with here, these detailed provisions of law, are going to find themselves into, shall we say, the consciousness or the awareness of a person who is living far out there, as the Honourable Member suggested, in the rural areas, who may not be literate, who may not have access to information, etc. That person may well see an incident of domestic violence happening, but they're not even going to know that the law requires them to report it. Yes, the doctor, the social worker, if it ever comes to their attention, they will know it. But the people who need help most are themselves not going to be helped by these provisions, in my submission.
Thank you very much, Mr. Porfia. Thank you for the presentation. The issues we have raised, we'll take them into consideration when we deliberate on the three bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members.
Thank you very much. Do we have the Mosaic organization here with us?
Yes, Chair, I am here.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Thank you very much. You can start. You have 20 minutes to make your presentation.
Right, fantastic. Thank you so much.
Good evening to the honourable members and other organisations that are in the room. My name is Karen Reese, and I'm the Advocacy Policy and Research Officer for Mosaic Training Service and Healing Centre for Women. I'm joined this evening by my colleague, Director of Mosaic, Advocate Tara Siam-Shutu Macmillan, who is in the room with us. I want to welcome the opportunity to make this oral submission in support of our written submission that I trust the honourable members have a copy of. And we would like to, at the outset, commend the committee and Parliament for prioritising gender-based violence legislation and the expediency with which it has been attended, especially during this time that has been marred by COVID-19. So before I get into our submission itself, just a very quick introduction to Mosaic. Mosaic is a community-based nonprofit or non-governmental organization, and we offer holistic and integrated programs aimed at preventing all forms of abuse and violence against women. And we do this by providing high-quality response services with incidences that occur and supporting our clients and beneficiaries through the process of healing and rebuilding their lives. We know that abuse and violence against women is deeply rooted and is at the core of rights violation on women and girls in South Africa. It's deeply systemic and rooted in communities, institutions, and cultures. Our goal is to end gender-based violence, with a specific focus on domestic abuse and violence. So we offer our services according to three service pillars, and that is in access to justice, support and healing, and empowerment. And this, we draw on our 27 years of practical implementation of firstly the Family Violence Act in 1993 and the current Domestic Violence Act that was enacted in 1998. And the experience that we've gained has been largely through our Access to Justice program and our Support and Healing program, where we've assisted victims of domestic violence within the courts, within domestic violence courts, in the protection order application process, as well as in our Support and Healing pillar, where we assist victims of domestic violence and their families in working through and ensuring that the protection order actually protects. So from the outset, just to say that I am only presenting on the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill, and I am cognizant of the committee's time and the long evenings that you've had, so I am going to try and keep it as brief as possible. In terms of the definitions, Mosaic welcomes the proposed expanded definitions and proposed amendments to further clarify and align with other existing legislation. But we particularly support the inclusion of the controlling and coercive behavior towards the complainant and related persons. This is something that was not clearly defined in the principal legislation, and it's really good to see that there, and something that is often overlooked in the issuing of protection orders at the court level. We also welcome the removal of repeated as a requirement for a protection order application. As we know, especially in instances of high levels of femicide that we're seeing now, it doesn't necessarily take repeated forms of domestic violence before a matter is fatal. When we're looking at the definitions, we do, however, propose a couple of amendments and inclusions. These include the definition of corporal punishment. We also call for the retainment of stalking, as has been made in quite a number of submissions to the committee. We make this submission for the retainment of stalking because it is a commonly understood and widely used term, and therefore needs to be retained in the bill. In the inclusion of all forms, we also seek the inclusion of all forms of corporal punishment in the definition of domestic violence. The definition of emergency monetary relief currently states that emergency monetary relief should be made for household necessities. We propose this be amended to existing household expenses rather than necessities, because the question then comes in, what are necessities? Finally, with definitions, we propose that the definition of related persons be extended to those offering assistance to the complainant, and that would include service providers who are providing services to the complainant. Chair and honourable members, I'm not going to spend too much time on Section 2A and Section 2B of the bill. It was covered in the joint submission that Mosaic had provided input on, and also our view and our submission on these sections align with many other submissions that have been made. But what I do want to highlight that in terms of Section A and the obligation of functionaries in relation to domestic violence, we propose that the bill should only place an obligation to report for domestic violence offences as set down in parallel existing legislation and as it relates to children, older persons, and those with disabilities. We do not support the obligation to report against adults. Mosaic also supports the addition of the proposed amendment which compels functionaries to assist in an incident of domestic violence in a standardized manner. And we feel that there could be some additions and amendments that could strengthen the support provided to victims in this response. And we've proposed some language around that. So here we're really talking about what is required once the matter has been reported to the police or to a social worker at the Department of Social Development. In Section 2B, the obligation to report and provide information, again, we support this provision as it is already mandated within existing parallel legislation, but we do not support the duty to report commission of acts of domestic violence against adults, and we call for the complete removal of this provision. Like the previous presenter, we seek that the criminalization of the failure to report for adults experiencing violence may actually reduce help-seeking behavior by women experiencing domestic violence, as well as removing a woman's agency on whether to report such violence. Family members and friends may themselves limit their support to a victim for fear of criminal liability and of failure to report. So this slide speaks to some of the amended language or the additional language that we propose for that outlines what the mandate should be of police and Department of Social Development when a matter is reported to them. And I'm not going to go through it now. It is listed in the written submission. And I think there are two options available to the committee here, either for this to be spelt out quite clearly in the provisions within the Principal Act, or alternatively that it be outlined very clearly in the directives attached to the Act. Then we welcome the increased use of technology. I think it's fantastic that we're seeing legislation move to current times, and we especially welcome the introduction of secure online submissions, especially for applications. And this is, as I said, it's welcome and supported, and especially around the online applications for applications brought to the court outside of ordinary court hours and days. What we do just want to bring some caution here is that we still make sure that there are magistrates available to take decisions and to consider those matters outside of ordinary court hours. We commend the department, or we commend the committee for noting that the clerk of the court needs to immediately submit the application and affidavits to the court. The use of the word immediately throughout the application process and the consideration is welcomed and something that we hope will be taken forward in the directives as well. The provision for the electronic delivery on the respondents as well as notification to the complainant is a welcome addition. We especially note that this reduces the burden on the complainant to follow up with the court as to whether an interim order has been served and whether they can obtain copies of the order as well as the interim warrants of arrest. So we welcome that provision. We, like many other presenters before myself, we also support the provision for the electronic repository. We feel that this will go a long way to provide a essential mechanism where information is easily accessed, but in addition to information being easily accessed, a complainant is able to then obtain and easily obtain a copy of their protection order from any magistrate court. And we know that in domestic violence, often property is damaged, and that is often the protection order itself will be burnt or discarded, and that results in it not being affected. So having the electronic repository provides complainants with more protection, if you could say that they're able to access it quite easily from any court. Then in the issuing of the final protection order, we welcome and support the amendments to this section, with the exception of the provision set out in subsection 2B, subsection 3, or triple I, where it states that if neither the complainant nor the respondent appears on the return date, the court may discharge the matter as one of the options. This provision has replaced the provision set out in the previous iteration of the bill that stated if the complainant does not appear on the return date and the court is satisfied that the application contains an affidavit made by or on behalf of the applicant that reports that the respondent has committed or is committing an act of domestic violence, the court may issue a protection order in the prescribed form. And B, the court must make provision to locate and or contact the complainant to establish reasons for not appearing on the return date. Our submission to the committee is that this provision be reinserted into this current bill, rather than providing magistrates with the option to purely discharge the matter. Then in section 7, what we would like to draw the committee's attention to is that the provisions as amended from the principal legislation that allows for a magistrate to make the decision for a respondent to not be allowed to enter the residence of a shared residence of the complaint with the complainant. What we propose is that this provision be strengthened so as to not be superseded by the Protection of Illegal Eviction from and Unlawful Occupation of Land Act or the PI Act or any other legislation that governs evictions. We therefore propose that the following provision be included or language similar to this that states a protection order may prohibit, suspend, or restrict the exercise of the respondent's rights to occupy the residence for the purposes of determining who has the right to remain living within a residence and who is obliged to vacate the residence. A protection order excluding a respondent from all or part of a residence shall take precedence over the information contained in the lease, the property deeds, or any other written agreement in respect of who has the right to inhabit the property. The terms of the protection order shall also take precedence over the provisions contained within the PI legislation or any other legislation governing evictions. Finally, we support the extension of directives to the Departments of Health, Social Development, Basic and Higher Education, and Training and Communications, in addition to the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development and South African Police Service. We know that for the longest time in the current Act, duty fell almost exclusively on the Department of Justice and Police. And we feel that this addition brings the amendment bill in line with the call for a multi-sectoral response to gender-based violence as outlined in the draft National Strategic Plan to Combat Gender-Based Violence and Femicide. But what we do propose is that a time frame of 6 months or a time frame agreed to by the committee from the date of promulgation of the Amendment Act be provided to the Director General from the respective departments to finalize the directives. So we don't sit with the case of multiple months after promulgation or years after promulgation that we do not have clear directives in place for the implementation of this law. With that, I'd like to thank the committee, and Chair, I welcome any questions.
The problem is with me. Sorry. Thank you very much. Mosiek. I have noted the following members, Honorable Mofokeng and Honorable Nibot Trachans. We'll start with Honorable Mofokeng.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. I just want to check on two things. I'm really happy because I saw that you're doing training and healing, the healing center. But in terms of training, I want to check that were you training people to also understand domestic violence as a act? And I would want to ask if maybe if you had complainants, because most of the time you find abuse comes with fighting for resources and all that. Were you advising people to also can actually go and open up a case for economic abuse? Because we found that most people don't actually look at that in the domestic violence. And we just want to know from your side, have you ever helped a person in that regard? And then on the issue of the orders, the protection orders, would you support the centralized orders? Because I've seen that you are really supporting on the electronic and on the online, which is a good thing. But there are those views of saying that it also goes to an extent of saying centralized orders can be something that we should look at, because it's submissions and we should be listening to everybody. And lastly, it's that it will be the issue of, can you share with us if you had any challenges with people that actually withdraw their cases and what does it do? Because we are aware that most of the women that actually have done that, most of
Honorable Mofokeng, unmute yourself.
Oh, I'm done, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you very much. Honorable Nibot Trachans.
Can everybody see me? And am I spotlighted?
Yes.
Thank you to Mosaic for your presentation. I have two questions. And because you've worked in the field for many years, I would like to ask something about something that has happened recently. When I saw the newspaper today, it says there's an increase of online gender-based violence. So that is on the increase. So what would your view be? Is there something that needs to be added in the bill to strengthen provisions against online domestic violence or gender-based violence? And then again, in the newspaper today, a member of SAPS was charged for gender-based violence. And now system is knowing that system, that the victim has a system against her because the perpetrator himself is in the police and has the backing of the police. So, you know, how would a victim get further assistance in the process, taking into consideration the challenges or obstacles put up against him or her in that situation? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to you, ma'am. Mosiek.
Thank you so much, and thank you for those questions. In terms of economic abuse, we, as Mosaic, we provide training and education at a very local community-based level on all forms of violence. We're also based in the magistrate courts themselves. So anybody, an applicant that appears at the court wanting to apply for a protection order, we actually assist them to do that. And that is where a lot of our education also comes in. And with that, actually raising awareness about what economic abuse is. Because I think there is very little understanding of what economic abuse is. So we do it on two levels. The one is in our community awareness, raising workshops and education groups with survivors and community members, but also with community leaders. Because I think it's important that we not only rely on Mosaic to provide this education, but really create a strong platform from where community members can get sound information. So that economic abuse is one that is not often brought to the fore unless you are really talking through to a complainant what the different forms of abuse are. So I think there's a lot more work that can be done around educating around the nature of economic abuse and also what processes are available to survivors who are experiencing economic abuse. In terms of protection orders and a centralized process, I think that anybody who goes to a magistrate court on a Monday morning and sees the queues of people waiting outside the domestic violence clerk's office will support a centralized system for protection order application. It's something that we see on, you know, we have the saying in the organization is you don't plan anything for a Monday. A court support worker cannot be out of the court on a Monday, because that is the day that a lot of protection order applications come in. But also we see that the highest levels of violence are on weekends. Now, we can talk about the social drivers and contributors to those high levels, but if we're talking legislation, we need to think of, well, what does that person need right then and there? So if we have people within various communities that understand the centralized order process and can do that application there, and there's a magistrate who's able to consider that application immediately, we will definitely increase the safety of complainants. Then challenges where people withdraw. I think this is quite a contentious issue, because from a procedural point of view, we don't necessarily want people to withdraw cases. But if we look at the lived experience of complainants, often they are intimidated to the point of you need to withdraw. And it's not always by the respondents. It can be by family. It can be out of the view for their children. It can be from a range of sources. So in terms of what we propose for people that withdraw, in one way, we want to propose that the court does everything it can to make sure that such an application to withdraw is not made under duress. But at the same time, understanding that the courts are seeing multiple cases and multiple applications to withdraw. So I think that's something that the committee needs to look at and maybe speak to the request submission from magistrates and prosecutors on this. And sort of what their ideas would be. But I think there needs to be a protective measure in the applications to withdraw, with considering applications. And then an increase in online gender-based violence, especially around issues of harassment, issues of sexual harassment, issues of domestic violence. Often what you find is when a protection order has been issued and it's stipulates you will not have access to the residence, you will not, provide verbal abuse or physical abuse, it often then moves digitally. So it moves into that digital realm. And social media, as much as we really created a very problematic platform for victims and survivors of domestic and gender-based violence. So in terms of the bill itself, I think the bill has gone a long way to really start thinking about what does this electronic form of violence look like? And I think it's quite sound in that way. I think where the challenge comes in is how to protect or how to present that information to the court. So How does it get attached to a protection order application? If an applicant comes to the court procedurally, they've got their phone, they've got the evidence, but how does it make it into the application? And I think having a centralized online system is great. You screenshot it, you upload it, it's there. So I hope that answers your question. Then the police member charge for gender-based violence, it's one of the honorable members in previous sessions actually spoke about complainants going to police to seek assistance, and yet the person themselves who are assisting them could be perpetrating violence at home. And this has been a challenge for a very, very long time. And I think we need to start looking at the police service in and of itself. We need to consider that members within the police service come from the same society, the same communities from which they serve, and we need to start looking at how do we change the service, and I don't think legislation can do that. I think we need to start looking at how do civil society, how do police, how does Parliament sort of all work together to try and say we need to start humanitarizing, I don't think that's a word, but how do we start humanizing the police service? How do we start really unpacking, firstly, who deals with domestic violence matters? Is it someone who's specifically trained for that? Is it someone who's sensitized to the needs of a victim of violence? But then also taking very strong and harsh disciplinary action against police who obstruct justice for victims of domestic violence. So that would be my suggestion and my submission. I know it's not a very tight, compact one, but I hope that helps.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you very much for your presentation. But we should not single out only police officers.
Yes.
You might find the magistrate or a prosecutor who in his or her house is also a perpetrator. I think this is a societal problem that we would need to attack. Thank you very much. And I was impressed that you also gave a wording that you proposed in one of the sections as to how it should be crafted. That is what we appreciate, that we don't possess all the wisdom, so we would like a society to assist in whatever form, so that we are able to have the best legislation that is not only good on paper, but a legislation that will be implementable, that will be able to change society. This issue of domestic violence is an emotional, is a very emotive thing, and it can affect all of us. Sometimes the tendency is to think that it affects only the illiterate women, the poor women, but even those that are highly literate, professional, are also highly affected, some of them, by this domestic violence and femicide. Thank you very much. I think we have come to the end of the meeting for today. Tomorrow we have a very packed program. Also, we will have to include the Women Legal Center and Professor Skelton. So we must be prepared at least to work until 4 o'clock. But I don't think that we will work beyond that time, but we'll try that by 4 we are done. And one of the things that I would want to emphasize is that as Parliament, as a committee, we give equal weight to written submissions and to oral submissions. We are bound to give consideration to all of them and give equal weight to both written and oral submissions. Thank you very much, members. Tomorrow we'll start at 9. Until we are done. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.